So when I'm thinking hustle, it's like...
So if I had to word association, activist hustle.
I think activism is just taking a stand.
People of color, minorities, existing as themselves fully and embracing the hell
you
out
don't,
of that.
You hustle to get something that like is not
I'm
on the road.
And not only that, everyone's struggling.
Ultimately,
always a light at the end of the tunnel. I would just say action every day.
Okay, so we're recording. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hi.
I am so excited for today. So I'm glad we got to tell our listeners why we were a little MIA. Mm-hmm. But I'm so excited to be back. Who do we have today?
Today, you'll be hearing from Javier Weddington, who is a science guy. That's like how I think of him after hearing the interview and talking with him. He shares so many good insights. And also, what's impressive about him is he can just like throw out statistics like from his memory. And that is like what I found super impressive.
I think he, what did you call him, a stats guy?
Science guy, stats guy, you know.
I totally see him as a science guy, which I think is so cool because one, activism exists in so many sectors and I'm so excited to have somebody who speaks on it from the scientific point of view. And even as we're saying like the stats guy, the science guy, do you remember back in season one where we were like so worried about naming our episodes a certain way that would like categorize and put our activists in a box? So I'm really excited to be sitting here and saying like to us, he's the science guy, but to everybody listening, he's going to be something else because of all of the things that he's tackling. I'm so excited.
Yeah, so he's going to share with you his research that he's doing at MIT. And then also he's the co-founder of the Boss STEM, STEM with an M, Scholars Academy, Scholars Program. That he does also.
Well, don't give too much
away. I won't. I'll let him. He can take it away from here. All right.
Perfect. Let's jump into it.
Hi, welcome to the Activist Hustle. Let's start off with just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, great. Hi, I'm Javier Weddington. I born and raised in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, to sort of family of three, but real family of eight. So my grandmother, mother, so forth, live in the same sort of house, and grew up with my uncles as siblings, sort of, and I also have two sort of twin sisters. That's like family background. But I am a neuroscientist and co-founder of the MIT Boston Scholars Academy.
And so tell us a little bit about your journey to being an MIT neuroscience PhD student.
Well, that's a misnomer. So I'm currently just a scientist there. My technical logo is a research associate or something like that. But I've recently been admitted to PhD programs, so I'll be doing a PhD this fall.
Great.
In neuroscience.
So what led you to take this path?
Yeah. So there's a lot. So it began with just generally wanting to be a scientist. So while I was on the interview circuit recently, meaning students would ask, you know, what brought you to neuroscience or whatever? And I'd say, well, I was really interested in being an astronaut. But then I was exposed to neuroscience. And I have this saying that I think that all neuroscientists have, you know, one of three things in common, or all. One, their father or someone in their family has been affected by some neurological disease. Two, they actually wanted to be an astronaut. Or three, they, you know, have a proclivity to, like, you know, drugs, like alcohol or cigarettes or whatever. Maybe those are the people who study addiction. But... I'm all three of those things. I'm interested in sort of like why people have addictive behaviors, but also social behaviors that stem from what we call the medial prefrontal cortex. It's sort of the evolutionarily youngest part of the brain. And it gives rise to many of the things that we call like decision making or sort of moral reasoning. And I'm interested in studying that sort of aspect of it. But the reason why I'm interested in the prefrontal cortex is because my father acquired frontal lobe damage. And He essentially hit his forehead really hard in a motorcycle accident, and it changed who he was. It changed his personality. And that sort of negatively affected me, obviously, because he wasn't able to regulate his emotions in ways that were normal. So basically, like, going into neuroscience is something, is trying to figure out, you know, what is the prefrontal cortex responsible for? And it turns out it's responsible for a lot of stuff. So the initial difference or reason why I got into neuroscience is because I saw this thing called a 3D MRI scan. And I've said this so many times before, but basically, they had two different scans, one of a normal brain and the other of someone's brain who had been damaged. And there were three voxels of a difference. Voxels are 3D pixel. There were three voxels of a difference between a normal brain and a not normal brain. And at that moment at 14, I was like, I want to be the missing link between the, you know, normal brain and not normal brain. So that was sort of at the time a bioengineering focused sort of thing. And it dawned on me when I was, I don't know, not that far past that same program when I was 14, that neuroscience is probably more interesting than doing bioengineering.
Wow. So it resonates because a lot of the things that call us to action are things that affect us or impact us directly.
True. That's very right? True. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what projects you're working on right now.
Great. Yeah. I'm studying the neural circuits underlying social dominance hierarchy. So imagine that you're really hungry, right? And that you walk into your office space and there's one slice of cheese pizza left, right? Hopefully you're not lactose intolerant. And you go and you reach for that slice of pizza, but at the same time, your higher up is also going for the same slice of pizza. Most people in that condition would withdraw their hand. They would retract their hand because, you know, they don't want any seam. And there are real social consequences to doing things that other people consider rude. Not saying that you're going to be fired for literally grabbing a slice of pizza, but it could have social effects down the line of, like, whether or not you're going to be promoted or whether or not, you know, people want to give you great recommendations, things like that. So what we study in the Thai lab at MIT is what cells encode dominance and subordinates in the brain, and then how can we perturb those cells, sort of change those cells' activity to either increase the likelihood of dominance or decrease it, or increase likelihood of subordinates or decrease it.
And so this is your academic project, though?
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you doing outside of the academic world?
I think that we all sort of have a responsibility to do something to make the people we come in contact with better, to sort of make the world better because we existed. And this was my sort of thing. So the thing that got me into co-founding the MIT Boston Scholars Academy was my experience in college. So I guess most recently, there's these articles coming out about how apparently wealthy people have been driving colleges to, like,
yes. You know, yeah. What a great time to talk about this, huh?
Yeah. So I think that's an important thing to sort of, I don't know, come out now, because I had never known that those things were illegal. I thought they were illegal. I thought it was normal. Normal to sort of pay your way through things. I went to Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and there was definitely a student in my class whose dad's name was on the library that we would go to. And I thought it was just normal. I thought it was a part of the system that if you're wealthy, you happen to have parents that went to your institution who are also wealthy, like, you could do anything you wanted to do in terms of, you know, collegiate rigors. But now learning that's legal gives me an entirely different lens on how difficult college was. So, first, college was really hard for me, and it was unbearably difficult. Like, I was the top of my class, like, coming out of high school, and not just top of my class in grades, but I went out of my way to take leadership positions, but also take summer school and sort of, like, take the opportunities necessary to bolster my academic career, right? Like, I finished a salutatorian, so I really tried my best to absorb as much as many of the resources that I could from my environment. But when I got onto a college campus and started my basic sort of science courses in biology and chemistry, I realized how far I was behind. So I didn't know what a cell was. I didn't know what you know, a nucleus mm-hmm. was, any organelles, like what the functions themselves were. And we were thrown into this sort of weed out course because a lot of people want to be pre-med and biology taking it in your first year is supposed to be sort of weeding you out. But you're getting weeded out among people who have already had AP courses. Mm-hmm. And I had two.
Or other types of training and yeah. courses that have, yeah.
Exactly. So the kids who were sort of not prepared to come into those situations were failing. And I was one of those students who were not doing well. And it wasn't that I wasn't studying. It wasn't that I wasn't trying or going to the professors. But, you know, I did all the things that they tell you to do in you know, orientation. Go to your teachers. Try to learn it. I did that. I studied with people. And my grades were still terrible. And after the first year of, like, sort of just having a rough time, I looked into the statistics of, you know, what's the likelihood of me being able to, like, finish this college degree? Like, what, like, why is this so hard? Like, I'm pretty sure people drop out. Like, what's going on with this? And it turns out that 14% of those who graduate from Chicago Public Schools will actually go on to finish college within 6 years. And
can you repeat that?
14% of the students who graduate from Chicago Public Schools will actually go on to graduate college within 6 years, right? And that was my sort of sparking moment. It was like, oh, okay, that, like, something's wrong with that. But then you look deeper. So that's like level one, is like most of y'all won't graduate. The second level is that four metropolitan areas, New York, LA, Chicago, Oakland, 80%, sometimes 75% of the public school population is made up of Black and Latino students. And also here in Boston. And that was a problem for me. It's like, okay, well, basically the system is disproportionately affecting Black and Latino people. And we have to, like, I have to do something about this. Like, there has to be something done about what our system's not giving us. Turns out, even more, that's first and second level. Third level is that for the kids that actually make it, for the kids that make it past, you know, the failing high school rates or, you know, get into college and want to pursue science, they want to pursue science at elite institutions and non-elite institutions at the same proportion as white and Asian students. Like, same proportion is sometimes more. Mm-hmm. But turns out, like, when they're ready to graduate, there's, like, you know, not that many of them around, right? Whereas in comparison to their white and Asian counterparts at the same schools, there'd be significantly more of those students who had initially been interested in the STEM fields finishing their degree in the STEM fields. So there were so many, like, issues or sort of secondary, primary issues, or primary, secondary, and tertiary issues that were related to people not being represented in STEM fields or not being professors or, you know, not making it past where I see. So that's what inspired me to make the MIT Boston Scholars Academy, to sort of encourage students to learn, essentially, encourage students to take on STEM seriously and finish their degrees in STEM.
So what, tell us more about the academy. What actually is it? What does it mean for you, and what does it mean for the students that are part of it?
So basically what we do is we bring kids from the Boston area to MIT to teach them biology, chemistry, physics, and computer science over the course of now 5 weeks. And the reason why I say now is because it went from 4 weeks to 6 weeks, and now it's 5 weeks. We've sort of optimized our amount of time that we want to have with our students. And we teach them using the flipped classroom approach. That means that they take their information home, so their sort of lectures home, and they watch them and do homework. And they come to class and they have hands-on activities. And these hands-on activities are sort of supposed to show the application of the tools that they're learning in school. That is sort of the gist. In addition to that, we also teach them sort of all the skills required to be successful as a scientist, like the soft skills, how to write an email to, you know, inquire for a position, or how to do an interview and how to follow up after an interview, and, you know, how to sort of package themselves professionally so that, one, they know how to present themselves, but two, the sort of overall function of the program is to change the loci of control, right, from external to internal. We want the students to believe that,
you know, I can do this if I work hard enough, not, you know, I can't do this because I'm from some other background or because these kids already have this opportunity and it's very different for them. But I believe and still believe that, you know, if you work hard enough, you can overcome some of those challenges. And I hope that we can change this the way that schools sort of teach students so they can become problem solvers instead of, you know, students who just memorize facts. And that's sort of my focus on things.
Like, what made you feel like this academy is definitely my way of activism? And I think, and the reason why I ask this is because a lot of the times in our episodes, and one thing that's been coming up a lot lately is when I'm interviewing someone, they say, you have to find what your role is in this, you know, in this wave of activism. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious as to how you found yours.
Well, I hope that none of the other activists out there dislike me for this, but I've participated in rallies, in hashtags, and also sort of marches, and I didn't find any of them effective. They make me feel better, but the policies that may have led to whatever reason that we're marching for haven't changed at the end of that march. And that still dissatisfies me today. So back when I was in high school, Hadia Pendleton, she's a high school student at King College Prep in Chicago, was killed. And it upset a lot of high school students. And a movement was born called Project Orange Tree. So myself and many other high school students sort of came together to develop a movement called Project Orange Tree, where we fought gun and gang violence and sort of also structural violence. So we wore orange to signify that we don't want to be shot. That's super simple, something that's taken from the concept of hunters. And it burned through the globe very quickly. It was super effective. I don't know. I don't want to say it was as effective as Black Lives Matter, because Black Lives Matter is still around and still, like, you know, very popular online. But I would say it was as effective. It burned through. People liked it. It was very popular. However, it just didn't last. And something about sustainability, to me, modeling a system and making it sustainable and scalable was the focus of whatever my next movement was going to be. And, you know, sort of having a solution that actually impacts the people and tries to solve the problem that we see, and also, like, sort of maybe modeling it such that it can be taken to another school and be like, hey, so we tried this, we have this data, like, here's what we know works, and you should try it with these 12 students, or you should try it with these 50 students. So designing the MIT Boston Scholars Academy, I went into it thinking, how can I design something that actually is sustainable and solves a problem? The thing is, I'm still not satisfied with, you know, how sustainable our thing is or how scalable it is, because we only serve 12 students a year, and it's mostly limited due to funding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, $25,000 a year funds approximately 12 kids, because you have to feed them and you have to make sure they get back and forth from the program. So that's just, it is really hard to maintain that, maintain it with more than 12 students, yeah, as we've seen so far.
And scale it.
Yeah.
But then again, to the, you know, on the other hand is, you're truly impacting 12 students.
Yeah.
And they are going to live on and continue to carry the skills and what they've learned. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they will impact another 12 students.
Oh, that's the goal.
Okay. Yeah, and yeah. So on and so on. So it's like, yeah, it is almost that, like, constant, I love what I'm doing, I'm not happy with the sustainability of it, mm-hmm, the longevity of it, mm-hmm, or how much more I could be doing, but at the same time I'm doing something,
yeah,
which is more than nothing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think to me is like another thing that when activism comes up, I'm like, will the activists ever be satisfied with the work, yeah, they're doing? And yeah, you've kind of touched upon this a couple, mm-hmm, of times as, mm-hmm, you've been talking, saying, like, you know, the Project Orange, is that what it was called?
Project Orange Tree.
Project Orange Tree, you did it, and you were like, okay, here's what I, mm-hmm, learned from it, here's what I don't like about it, here's what I like about, mm-hmm, it, and on to the mm-hmm, next one. So that actually brings me to my next question, which is, what does activism mean to you?
I don't know. I mean, it means different things for different people. For me, that means just doing something. So if you see something wrong, you try to change it. I don't know.
Yeah.
You could. I guess that could be. That's super basic.
Would you consider yourself an activist?
Actually, used to avoid the term activist.
Tell me more.
I actually don't think that I'm an activist.
Say more.
I mean, because when I think of activists, I think of people who are popular, and in addition to those people being popular, think about those people who were popular who made a change. And so, you know, the classic examples are Martin Luther King.
I knew you were going to say Martin Luther King.
That's like standard.
You know, it's activist. So funny. Yeah. Martin Luther King has become the face of activism.
Yeah.
And in this country especially, it's wild how much now, especially like when MLK Day comes, everybody's like, let's do service today. Exactly. Let's, you know, it's turned into the face of activism.
There are different, so many different types of activism, but I don't know. I feel like I'm not necessarily worthy of being called an activist. I think that I do the thing that I'm called to do. I do the thing that I feel responsibility to sort of change. But whether or not that's activism is sort of up for other people to decide. I actually think that being an activist has more to do, or being interpreted as an activist has more to do with the way that people interpret you or the things that you do. So if you're out there making a change and people are like, oh, like you're being active, you're like changing things or whatever, it's like, so then it's for them to decide. It's the same way if someone said that you're mean, like you don't get to decide if you're mean, right? Like you're mean and you need to change like who you are in order to not be interpreted as mean. I think because activism is directly linked to sort of helping others, it is up to the others to determine whether or not you are that thing.
So this question makes me reflect on two things. One, most of the activists that we have on here, because you are an activist,
okay,
by your own definition, right?
Yeah.
But the first question I asked you was, what does activism mean to you? And by definition, you are an activist.
Yeah.
And two, and so that's one, and linked with one is, nobody that we have on the show says, yeah, absolutely. Like they all struggle to admit that they are activists, which is wild to me. And then two, it makes me reflect on the self-proclaimed activists, like the people who are walking around saying like, I'm an activist. You don't have to own the title to actually be it. And if you do own the title, like then you're kind of like stuck to it.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're kind of held to that, which is also a lot of pressure.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, next question. What challenges have you faced in bringing about the work of the Boston Academy, Scholars Academy?
First problem is money. Like you need money to start things. So you have to be able to, you know, write a really good grant and submit a really good grant and also present your work well, to present what you want to do and how you plan to execute it and hope that someone believes in it.
So actually, let's pause there and go deep into this because I think this is really valuable. And we live in a society where like money drives everything, right? And so how were you able to, one, identify that you needed to do those two things, and then two, overcome the fact that those were the biggest challenges?
Yeah, I generally, also when mentoring other people on doing sort of similar nonprofit things, I tell them to write from passion. That writing really can be a way out of your issue. So writing from passion meaning, you know, you take your issue, you sort of research it, you become even more emboldened in your perspective, kind of look at different perspectives of different things, you know, challenge your perspective. So one thing that challenged my perspective recently was that, so currently right now on sort of Twitter and sort of science Twitter specifically, there's like women in STEM and stuff. And I agree with the women in STEM movement, and I want it to be something that matters and sort of something that's endorsed and pushed for. There's one thing I didn't mention about the data I talked about earlier, is that if you look at the way the college sort of, if you look at who graduates college within 6 years based on race and sex, it's like Black and Latino males are unlikely to graduate. Like significantly less likely to graduate than Black and Latino females, and significantly less likely to graduate than white or Asian males or females. It's ridiculous. The reason why that's a problem is that there's like, I don't know, there are these ideas that you might have about, you know, how you're supposed to help and sort of what you're supposed to do. But as you're doing your research, as you see your sort of perspectives being challenged, it's like, oh, well, yes, there are more men than women in STEM, but if we look at it in terms of race, there's no black dudes, right? So it's like, well, not no. It's like, I don't know, an abysmal number of black dudes. So take the approach of, first of all, writing from passion and reading from passion, but also try to challenge your own perspective on sort of preconceived notions that you might have before you write something that is totally just false, it's totally just made up, right? And you have to have others around you who can sort of ground you in the truth to sort of show that what you're doing is, first of all, important, but also that the approach you're taking is a good approach, or is the approach to take. And that's, I don't know, not that hard. I guess you could have friends around you, like having friends who have a good mind or have a similar mind is pretty good. And someone to obviously read your grant and help you sort of work through your grant or work through your ideas of being like, well, why don't we take this part and, you know, expand more on this thing or expand more on that thing. And maybe we should minimize these parts, right? Because that is what can create a powerful enough grant to submit. And then also, I think writing is a part of the process of thinking. So then when you go to speak about your subject, you can speak about it much more eloquently and have data that you can just, like, you know, say off the top of your head because you have the experience of having researched it in writing something about how you want to change it, how you want to implement your solution. And it sort of develops over time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And how would you go about telling others who are out there who are like, okay, I've got this, like, I've got this cause mm-hmm. that I really care about. I've got this idea on how to tackle that issue mm-hmm. Or move forward the anti of that. And I'm a great writer. I finally figure out how to mm-hmm. put all my passion into words. Where do I go for money?
You have to find people who have grants. You have to find things online. There's a lot of different grant things online, which I haven't sent in a grant in a while, actually. I have a team of people, which I want to shout out. Shout out to my entire team
in
Boston. So currently the director is Megan Davis. She's a sophomore at MIT. And the curriculum developers are Kenny and Fidelia. And they're developing a very robust sort of different version of the MIT Boston Scholars Academy, where they're focusing on epidemiology and sort of having a project-based course. We also have Sam Allen, and he's submitting grants and mm-hmm. also like making sure that all of our numbers are good. And then there's Ashley Simon, who's like our community activist, sort of like working, like talking to people and being able to communicate to the Boston high schools or the Cambridge high schools that we exist. So entire team, shout out, because I don't know, I feel like activism in general is right. We highlight the activists, but we don't oftentimes highlight the people who matter just as much as the activists.
Well, and they're kind of activists in themselves, exactly. Right? Like they're all contributing to this movement, which actually brings me to another question. So for listeners out there who, same scenario I just laid out, mm-hmm. but who are like, man, I really can't do all of the things that you just said, mm-hmm. right? Like on my own. How did you go about finding this team, and would you recommend that others do the same or something different?
So year one was very difficult. I had to write everything on my own. I had to do all the presentations myself. I had to reach out to all the students myself. I had to ask for volunteers alone. I had to raise money and manage the bank account alone. And I just begged for help from so many people and sort of had to make it work. It was very much like a startup. Mm-hmm. Where you just connect with as many people possible. And there are many people who I am definitely going to forget names. So I would say thank all of you.
But when you say that, what do you mean? Like many people, like who are, where were they? How
everyone.
Did you go
so
about
if,
finding
if
them?
I guess what I found in my life is that if you're really passionate about something, if you really care about something, you say it enough and you say that you want to do something enough, someone else is going to have a similar interest. Someone else is going to connect you with a person who can do the thing that you're interested in. And that like takes shape.
So essentially starts at being vocal.
Yeah, starts at being vocal and like being really passionate about the thing that you want to do. It's really hard to do things without a team. But if you're starting it on your own and you really believe in your cause, eventually someone else will also agree. And it may not happen in your first year It may not even happen in your second year. For me, it worked out that, you know, my first year was sort of alone where I'd have to manage the entire thing myself. And you know, with the help of many different volunteers and many different friends. And then the second year, we actually had a team. And now the third year, we have still a sort of cohesive team. But doing it alone is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. It's not sustainable. It's something that it will break down eventually. It's good for starting things. It makes you feel good that you've done something yourself. But in order to have something live beyond you, you must have the ability to communicate your craft or communicate why your sort of approach on activism is important, so that other people are also pull themselves in. Second thing about that is that, and when you pull those people in, do not overwork those people. Try to delegate to like reduce the likelihood that someone will quit. And so you delegate evenly enough so that the work is just not that hard. It's just like, oh, well, I only have to do this. I only have to do that. And all those parts come together to make a cohesive product. And it's like, all right, well, this is the thing that we've done. And now it's doper because we've all contributed to this thing.
Right. So one thing I keep hearing is like the passion speaks for itself, whether mm-hmm. it's through your writing to do grant making mm-hmm. or whether it's to recruit your team mm-hmm. or whether it's to just start something. It's like to really commit to what you're passionate about and be vocal about it, because it will speak for itself. Mm-hmm. The second thing I just heard to say, and I need to give a shout out now to my team, because yeah, it resonates so well. You know, I feel like I couldn't do this on my own. Like, there's no way that I could interview, do the setup and the prep and edit the episodes as well. You know, like all of it. There's mm-hmm. just no way that you can do that. It's just doing my part alone is already sometimes hard enough, mm-hmm. let alone all the other parts. But it also speaks to the second portion of our title, which is the hustle, mm-hmm. right? So when you said, like, I was starting off on my own doing this, this, and this, mm-hmm. that sounds like the hustle. And it's changed a little bit because you were able to have a team and to delegate. So tell us, what does the hustle look like for you right now as you balance, like, the project that you're doing mm-hmm. academically, but also still managing this, I don't want to call it a side project, but just a different project?
Mm-hmm. The hustle looks like sleeping a lot.
Yeah.
So sleeping is underrated. There's so many fun facts about, you know, how important sleep is. There are, you know, neuroscientific studies that have been done about, you know, if you get less than 6 hours of sleep, the next day, your efficiency, like your cognitive abilities, are like 60% what they could be. And that, like, that's not good. And sort of like not sleeping will reduce the likelihood of you being effective the next day. So I sleep a ton. I sleep maybe 8 to 10 hours a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I sleep a lot. And sometimes I'll sleep more than that. I'll sleep a lot. But during the times that I'm working, I work effectively, and sort of have very concentrated hours of just working very hard, and also communicating with people in quick ways where it's like, all right, well, here's information, here's the connection, here's the thing, and getting things done when you say you want to get them done instead of sort of putting them off, mm-hmm. Because procrastination can lead to, I don't know, things piling up, and I don't like things piling up on me. The third thing is sort of in tangent to not procrastinating is starting stuff earlier. My grad school essays, were sort of in the making for approximately 2 years. And it's just like, well, I'm going to do it eventually. So I just like put pieces of my life together while I was writing them and having, like, you know, them be edited and come back and forth. But it took approximately 2 years to get the final product of what I submitted. So starting early and dividing up your work, for me, that's worked a lot.
Yeah. Time management, huh?
Yeah, I mean, time management, but also just your focus. Honestly, if you slept and you felt good and you were healthy, you'd probably just be like, I don't know, 90 times more effective than the tired version of yourself. And I don't know, whoever's listening to the podcast, I think that they should definitely take sleep seriously.
Yeah. And maybe take a nap after listening to this.
Take a nap after listening to this. Like, naps are good. Sleep is healthy. And it's a biological function that has literally been, like, I don't know, programmed into us, right? You can't live without it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. What would you say to people who feel like they need permission to do that, or that they're not living up to, right? Because you kind of said it when we were talking about the college thing, mm-hmm. and it resonated with me that, you know, I was the first generation, like, literally came from Colombia when I was 10. Mm-hmm. My mom's never been to college. Like, nobody in my family had ever been to college. Got into college, got a full ride, and mm-hmm. immediately I felt like I owe them, right? Like, yeah. I felt this responsibility of, like, I need to be involved in every club. Mm-hmm. I need to get straight A's. Mm-hmm. I need to, you know, and I stretch myself so thin. Mm-hmm. And when people would say, like, take it easy, or like, wow, you're doing a lot.
Yeah.
I never thought, like, you're right. Let me rest or let me slow down. Yeah. Like, I felt like I needed permission to do that, mm-hmm. because I felt like I was in a place where I didn't, you know, I had gotten into a place that I didn't deserve to be, or didn't see other people like me. And so I had to work extra hard. So how would mm-hmm. you, what would you say to the person out there that's like not, you know, that essentially is feeling like they need permission to do that, or don't even realize that the reason why they're not doing it is because nobody's saying, like, it's okay to do this.
Yeah. For a person who feels like they can't sleep because they haven't done it, I resonate with that, and I understand where they're coming from. Because I was definitely one of those people. I honestly think that there's not much advice that you could give a person who is working really hard to accomplish the goal that they want to by saying, you know, you should chill out or whatever. I don't think it works. Because it's much easier for a person who's, you know, had their successes with activism or had their successes with science to say that, oh, it's okay, it's not that serious, like, you'll make it eventually. I think it's hard to see it from that, from the perspective of, you know, the older person who has accomplished already. Simply because they've done it and you haven't done it, you still wanting to do it. And also they did it. So maybe it's required at some point. But I think that it's a lesson that has to be learned on its own.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sort of go into that failure. You have to not sleep.
You have to not value sleep the
for like 2 days or 3 days, whatever, and then you realize that you're, you know, not performing well, or that you don't feel healthy, or whatever. You study for this exam and you take the exam because, you know, you thought you were smart, but your brain's not very good at telling you that you're tired, right? It's not good at that. Like, it can definitely trick you into thinking that you're awake, but you just have to sort of explore it on your own. I mean, maybe you can take the advice of others, but you most likely will have to just explore not sleeping and see the effect of it before you can value sleeping.
And sometimes you don't even know that's what you need, right? Like, yeah. Sometimes that's why it needs to happen.
Yeah.
And I know we're specifically talking about sleep because that's what you mm-hmm. have determined as mm-hmm. your hustle, but mm-hmm. for others it might be different things, and it might be things like eating healthy or mm-hmm. going to the doctor, or, you know, just any type of thing that you feel like is setting you back or would set you back. Mm-hmm. I would encourage all of you to just try it,
yeah.
and see how you function yeah. after doing that,
because
it looks very different for all of us, but yeah. it's very real, right? And we need to get there. It's like almost like that saying, what is it? It's like you have to, like, hit rock bottom mm-hmm. to truly start going up. Mm-hmm. And, like, you don't know that. You don't know what rock bottom is until, like, you're at it, right? Yep. And, like, every time life hits you with something, you're like, oh, this is it. And it's like, not yeah. really. Here yeah. you go. And then that's when you truly learn that lesson.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you see next for yourself?
Next, I'm going to head off to grad school and, you know, start establishing myself in my neuroscience community and also my grad school community. There's many different parts of things that mattered about grad school. First of all, the science, and second of all, like, the people in the community that you're in. So I want to establish as quickly and, you know, as, like, well as I can that I love the people there. And so I'm going to probably spend a good 2 years establishing that before I care about practically anything else. I mean, obviously I'm going to take classes and I'm going to, you know, do science and probably also do outreach, but making sure that the people in my community feel heard by me or feel connected to me probably matters most.
Great. How can people find you or get connected to the causes that you're working on?
So they can find us at boston.mit.edu. Our application for students and teachers are now open. You should totally apply if you want to be a teacher. We have you all teach for approximately a week. And students, it's a 5-week program. Anybody from the Boston area is invited to apply. It's sort of a 2-essay, 1 recommendation, and what else is there? Transcript. like a super simple, straightforward application. And we would love to have, you know, more students. You can also sort of add me or follow me on Twitter at Javier Kari with an apostrophe, which is, I don't know, whatever. Like, we can put it on a link, something or something like that.
Yes, right? We will have both the links to the application and to the Twitter.
Great. But yes, we would love to, you know, receive applications from students and also teachers.
Awesome.
I'm not going to lie, Rachel, during this interview, I found myself a lot of time being like, can you slow down? Can I catch up to these terms that you're using and really following like the neuroscience of it and then jumping to the projects that he brought to MIT and his identity and then like the forming of his team, like just so much stuck out.
Yeah, I think he did such a good job at like reflecting on his whole story and his whole journey. And he did say that he had just gone through a bunch of interview process, the interview process for going back to school. So I totally get that as being why he was so good at telling his story, because he said, he's like, I've said this so many times, but I think it really helped us like going along with how his family started, to how it was for him in college, to how it was for him starting out in the STEM field and going through Project Orange Tree and the Boston Scholars. I think that he just laid everything out in such a good way for us to reflect on what we can take from his journey.
Agreed. And it's almost like the more that you say it, so there was something that really stuck with me that he said, which was around the time that I asked him, like, how do you do it? How do you get the team of people? And he said, like, you just, if you are passionate about what you do and you say it all the time, like, things will just fall into place. And I think that that takes so much patience. And truly, like, being able to articulate it in the right way or in the perfect flow. And I think that he has perfected this when he was telling us a story and telling us that he's, you know, saying this a lot. And so that's why he's able to talk about it the way that he does. Not everybody is there. I meet so many people that have really great ideas, but have really hard time articulating them or explaining them almost like in an elevator pitch. And that really, really stuck with me out of this interview. What else stuck with you?
I think I want to just expand on the point that you just mentioned, because when I think of people in my life who I view as activists or like approaching, who are working on a cause, then I almost like associate that person in my mind with whatever they're working on. And that's because like whoever they are, like they just talk about it all the time. Like they're always thinking about how do I X, Y, and Z, fill in the blank. Like for me, like I hope someday that I'll talk enough about inequities in childbirth, especially racial disparities, that like when you think about me, when you think about Rachel, like that's what you'll think about. Or like when you think I want to learn more about whatever, like who am I going to call? Like that's kind of where you want to get yourself to be, to the point where you're just like not afraid to talk about what you care about. And then that's kind of where growth sprouts from.
And we've talked about this earlier in earlier episodes about the importance of your network, right? And we've talked about like network in terms of resources, but one of the biggest resources is the wealth of knowledge and the passion that we carry. And so anytime, remember when we were doing our first episode this season about the refugee crisis, we were like, who are we going to call? And immediately we thought of people in our network. We just constantly hear them talking about this being the cause that they care about and the cause that they've kind of signed on to for their lives. And that was really, really just like validating to that
Notion. Totally.
Like, we're not making this up, people. We really aren't. But that the whole part about finding his team was also just really cool in terms of understanding that sometimes, you know, when you do start things alone, you do start things on your own, the idea sometimes just comes from you and you find yourself alone. But I found it so pleasing that he said, or comforting that he said, but that doesn't always have to be the case. And to truly create something that's transformative and that will live beyond you, you have to bring in other people, because that's how it will live on after you. And like, that legacy essentially stuck with me so much, because I think so often I'm like, I want to do this, I want to do that, and I get caught, like, bogged down on the, like, I don't have a team, I don't have the capacity. But at the same time, it's like, it will get there when it does. Like, it needs its own journey. And if it's, you know, if it's effective, and if the thing becomes a thing that is doing the right thing, enough people will sign up for it that it will live on beyond the creator
of
it.
Totally. Yeah, the legacy is, like, kind of what we're all striving for. I think that's especially kind of in activism. It comes up a lot. Yeah, and he also said a point about how you just have to have other people around you to ground you in the truth. And whether you're, like, working on a project alone or you have a team, I think that you need to find the people who will check you. Like, they, because sometimes people in your own team also won't, especially if you are, like, a founder or president of a whatever project. They'll just kind of be like, yeah, let you do you. Like, they're all making the decisions, you know? And sometimes that's your friends. That's your friends that you have to find, your team of friends that will ground you in the truth, because sometimes that's what you need.
Agreed.
I think another point that we wanted to highlight, I would say, in this reflection is his definition for the hustle. So I think we can just talk about that a little bit, don't you think? It's major. Revolutionary, I'd even say.
And also something that, again, is so individual to the person. Like, I was, and I think the listeners could hear it in my reaction to him saying what his hustle was, which was, like, getting enough sleep. But when he was, and I know that, listeners, you couldn't see his face, but let me tell you, this man was serious. Like, he was like, nope, I need 8 hours of sleep a night. And I was like, what?
He was ready for that answer too. I feel like in so many interviews, we ask people, like, what's your hustle? And they're like, what does that question even mean? Like, what's your hustle? You know, like, they'll ask Lena back. And he was, like, ready. He was like, the hustle, sleep, 100%. You know, like, he was so ready.
He was so ready. And the other thing that really stuck with me, it's like, there's no way. So often, you know, there are negative, we do relate sometimes, like, sleeping with negative terms, like being lazy or, like, not wanting, you know, and it's like, this person knows what works for them. They know, and I have friends like this too, that they know they need a certain amount of sleep to operate. They know that they need, and just the fact that he brought it all back and said, you know, if I show up to work and I'm not my best self and I'm not feeling great, and then he brought the scientific side of it too, which I was like, maybe I should be getting more sleep. But I think, like, I'm just in a routine where, like, 8 hours of sleep seems like wild to me when I'm in the thick of it. But truly appreciating that not everybody operates like I do, and that doesn't mean that we're not operating in the same, you know, like, he could be being way more productive and efficient than I am, even though I feel fine and I don't feel like I need it. And so that really stuck out to me, like, truly honoring what each individual person needs and then doing it. And I love that he owned it and he was like, yep, this is how much I need and I know that. And if I don't get that, then I'm not going to be okay. And so everything else has to, you know, work around that. And I was like, gosh, I need to be able to do that too. I think we all need to find that thing in our lives that's like, this is what defines our mood and our, you know, and our ability, like, whether it's eating healthy or being active or getting enough sleep or a combination of all three, and then going out and doing the work and feeling okay about having taken that time to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely like owning that self-awareness, which I think we've talked about a little bit before, and also avoiding the urge to sabotage yourself, which I think we've also talked about this before in a way where sometimes, like, in our psyche, we think, like, especially in activism, if we're not, like, running ourselves into the ground, we're not working hard enough, if we don't feel really terrible and by, like, not getting more than a couple of hours of sleep every night, like, are we really putting in the work that our cause deserves? Mm-hmm. And really all we're doing is self-sabotage. And it's just saying, like, that's not the culture that we're trying to keep going in this field of, like, nonprofit and activism, we're trying to like change that narrative to be like, yes, this is what it means. It means taking care of yourself so that you can bring 100% of your effort every day that you come into the office, or like separating your like causes from having your time of having a good time or whatever. So I think that that comes back again and again as a theme.
And it's not sustainable. So I think that that's the other thing. We're talking to activists who are really being intentional about having something that is sustainable. And so when we talk about these things, like, is that realistic? Like, can I continue to do that forever? So
yeah, and that's like a key point. And when you're like asking someone, how is your project going? What is it sustainable? It's like, that's what you should be thinking about. Yeah, I feel okay to keep running this for the next 20 years of my life and feel like I'll be well rested.
Exactly. And it's also what we just did. So I'm so excited that we're back, and I'm so excited that we took the time for us to rest and revamp and regroup. And I'm so glad that we released this episode, and I can't wait for our next one. What's next?
Yeah. Next, we are going to keep on going with our deeper dives into the topics that are coming out of the interviews that we've done. So this will be our third try at that. In a couple of weeks, you will hear Lena and I talking about some. Okay, so I am like totally guilty pleasure into pop culture, and everyone is still talking about the college admissions scandal. So we're going to be talking about that and how it kind of is a part of just like generally education inequalities in the country.
As they should be. That, you know, I often think about, and that's why I keep referring back to season one and season two, because all of these causes and all of these issues aren't things that we're doing for clickbait or that we're doing just to like jump on the bandwagon of whatever the news story is. It's like, these are issues that are still happening and will continue to happen even after we bring them to light. So we should be discussing them even after the media frenzy has died down. And I can't wait to go into this one.
Yeah, we need some time for that one.
Exactly. So yay, we're so glad we're back. We're so glad all of you are back. And stay tuned for our next episode.
Bye.
And we're going to take a moment to thank everybody who made this podcast possible, starting with you, the listener. Without you, there would be no us. I'd also like to thank the Activist Hustle team, starting with Rachel Sullivan, your producer and director, Aaron Taylor, our producer and editor, Brandon Rush, our creator, Amina Chandani for your creative logos and constant creative input, The Yard for lending us your space to record, and a final shout out to Blueprint Leadership. If this episode has at all inspired you to take action, remember, we have support for you. Blueprint is a leadership program made by young activists for young activists. Check out blueprintldc.com/services and see how we can support you on your activist hustle.